Blog Talk Radio.
Bring
Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I'm your host, Abayomi Azikiwe, and we want to, of course, wish everyone a happy Juneteenth Day, which is now a federal holiday in the United States, honoring the emancipation of Africans from enslavement in the United States in 1865. And later on in our program, we'll be coming up with our regular Pan-African Newswire report. We'll have dispatches on the continental tributes being paid to former Zambian co-founder and President Kenneth Kaunda. Malawi is reporting that the country has depleted its supply of coronavirus vaccines. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has made an appeal to maintain the national unity of the Horn of Africa state. And Sudan and South Sudan are still discussing border demarcation some 8 years after the partition. In the second hour, we explore the life, times, and contributions of President Kenneth Kaunda. Finally, we continue our focus on Black Music Month with examinations of the works of Dinah Washington and Willie Mae Thornton. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. Stay tuned. And we're going to bring you music from Zambia from 1975 from the band entitled Amanaz, electric rock music from Zambia during the 1970s. And let's listen in this Black Music Month of 2021. Thank you.
I'm gonna miss you. something new about the Israeli man. Cause he's got nothing to lose. So he's got something better. Thank you.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, the worldwide radio broadcast, and we just heard the music of Zambia's Aminaz from their only album released in 1975 entitled Africa. And, of course, the band Aminaz was a Zambian rock band. It was founded in 1973 in Kitwe, Zambia. The group released their only album, the acclaimed Africa. That happened in 1975, as I mentioned earlier. Aminaz drew influences from United States as well as British rock music of the late 1960s and early 1970s, especially the music of Jimi Hendrix, and from traditional Zambian music identifiable in Watson Lungu's drumming and Keith Kabwe's vocals. The band name is an acronym, Ask Me About Nice Aristides in Zambia. In 1973, the band recorded in the Malachite film studios of Changola. Their solo album named Africa. It was first released as an LP in 1975. Since then, it has been reissued by the German label Shadox Music in 2008. And by a U.S. label, Now Again Records, in 2015. Of the 12 songs of this album we just heard, three are performed in the Bemba language, and the rest are in English. And the album continues to be influential as an embodiment of a strain of Zamrock or Zambian rock music. One music critic, Mark Deming, noted that Aminaz's music was based on, quote, deep bluesy grooves with a strong psychedelic undercurrent and thick layers of fuzz guitar, unquote. The band split up in 1976. Keith Kabwe, the former band leader and main vocalist, then created the short-lived band Drive Unit later in 1976. And the latest reports we had was that Kabwe is now a Pentecostal minister in Mbala, Zambia, and is working on releasing gospel songs. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, worldwide radio broadcast for Saturday, June 19th, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. And, of course, this is Black Music Month, June of every year. We pay tribute to the diversity and the variety of music, at least some aspects of music, because it is so vast, coming from the African world community. And right now we want to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment. Our lead story, of course, deals with the recent passing of Pan-African leader, theoretician, former President of the Republic of Zambia, Dr. Kenneth Kaunda. And all across the African continent, there have been messages of sympathy, condolences, and solidarity. The African National Congress said that the story of South Africa's liberation would never be complete without the full acknowledgement of the role played by Zambia's Dr. Kenneth Kaunda. The country's governing party, which had set up camps in Zambia, in Lusaka, the capital, during the struggle for liberation, has paid its tribute to Kaunda and has sent condolences to his people following his death just 2 days ago on Thursday, June the 17th. Dr. KK, as he was fondly known, was hospitalized earlier this week. The African National Congress said that Kaunda's passing was a sad moment for South Africa and the rest of the continent. Frelimo, the MPLA, the Popular Movement for the Liberation of Angola and the Mozambique Liberation Front, the Zimbabwe African People's Union, the Zimbabwe African National Union, the Southwest Africa People's Organization, SWAPO, and the African National Congress, ANC. These are just some of the continent's liberation movements that found a warm place under Kaunda's wings. The ANC has lauded Zambia's founding president for his enduring friendship with this country and some of its own beloved leaders like Oliver Tambo and Nelson Mandela. It is said that Kaunda opened his country to ANC members for more than 30 years, describing Zambia's first black president as the pride of the continent. Over the years, the Zambian leader had joined efforts to raise awareness about HIV and AIDS, and more recently, COVID-19. It said that Kahuna's legacy and those of other selfless African leaders should be used as an inspiration in the fight for an Africa that was free from landlessness, poverty, and human suffering. And the South African government as a whole has also acknowledged the passing of former President Kenneth Kaunda. South Africa has declared 10 days of national mourning for Zambia's founding President Kenneth Kaunda, who died at the age of 97 following a bout of pneumonia, the presidency said yesterday. Zambia under Kaunda was one of the countries most opposed to the apartheid government and for decades hosted the exiled African National Congress on Zambian soil. Kaunda was the first foreign leader South African liberation icon Nelson Mandela visited on his release from prison in 1990. In remembrance of this great leader, the South African government has declared a period of mourning for 10 days with immediate effect, and that's from a statement issued by President Cyril Ramaphosa. Zambia itself is observing 21 days of national mourning with flags flying at half-mast, and all entertainment is banned. Ramaphosa said Kaunda is a, quote, rightfully revered father of African independence and unity, whose leadership was a source of inspiration and resilience. Under his leadership, Zambia provided refuge, care, and support to liberation fighters who had been forced to flee the countries of their birth, said President Ramaphosa. President of South Africa, Cyril Ramaphosa, went on to say that of the fallen Zambian leader, he stood alongside the people of South Africa at the time of our greatest need and was unwavering in his desire for the achievement of our freedom. We will never be able to repay the debt of gratitude owed to Kaunda, Ramaphosa said. In neighboring Botswana, President Mokgweetsi Masisi has ordered 7 days of mourning in honor of the selfless Kaunda, an iconic statesman of the highest credentials. Kaunda ruled Zambia for 27 years, taking the helm of the country when it gained national independence from Britain in October of 1964. While in power, he hosted many of the movements fighting for independence or black equality in other countries around the region. And, of course, we're going to continue to cover the passing and mourning of former Zambian President Kenneth Kaunda, and you can read more of these statements over on the Pan-African Newswire. And another news taking place in Malawi, delays in coronavirus vaccine shipments to Malawi have caused health facilities to run out of doses as hundreds are due to receive the second shot. That's according to the health minister. They said that earlier today. The Southern African country has so far received 300,000 doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine from the United Nations, 102,000 from the African Union, and 50,000 donated by the government of India. The inoculation started in April, and the country was expecting a second United Nations shipment of 900,000 by the end of May, 4 weeks before the first vaccinated Malawians would be due a second dose. But Health Minister Kumbizi Kandoto said that batch had been delayed by a recent surge in coronavirus cases in India, the world's main AstraZeneca supplier, which forced the country to temporarily halt major vaccine exports to meet local demand. The situation in India has delayed the supply, Kandoto told the Asian France Press earlier today, adding that the vaccines would only arrive in July or August. Hundreds of people are seeking to get vaccinated were turned away from Malawi's main Kamuzu Central Hospital in the capital of Lilongwe this last past week. The hospital has told us that there is nothing they can do because they simply do not have vaccines. That's according to a taxi driver, Jaffe Ngwali. He told that to the AFP yesterday, distraught by the inability to receive a second dose on time. The Africa Centers of Disease Control and Prevention warned in April that India's vaccine supply delay would undermine inoculation plans on the African continent. Africa has been slower than other regions in immunizing its population against coronavirus. Only 2% of Africans had received at least one vaccine jab at the start of June. compared to 24% of the world's population, according to the World Health Organization. Malawi hopes to inoculate around 11 million people, 60% of the population, by the end of 2021. But just over 380,600 people in Malawi have received the first shot so far, of which more than 33,200 are now fully vaccinated. Widespread vaccine hesitancy has also hindered the rollout. The government was forced to destroy 17,000 expired vaccines last month due to a low turnout. You're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. I'm your host, Abayomi Hazikwe. In the Horn of Africa nation of Ethiopia, the Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said earlier today that the country needed national unity amid increasing foreign pressure from the world's powers in the West. He shared a metaphorical message on social media where he elaborated the connotation of activities and practices performed in circular social gatherings as a demonstration of unity. He talked about Ethiopians eat and dance together, the coffee ceremony, and traditional house structure. Circle, he said, is a symbol of boundlessness, eternity, and equality. We need to encircle Ethiopia today, he added, so as not to let those who want to divide our wholeness and challenge our unity. We need to make a circle that will not let intervention in equality, and by holding one another, let us show the world our unity and perfect wholeness, he added. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's government has been under increasing pressure from Western interventionist campaigns on alleged grounds of human rights abuse in the Tigray region of Ethiopia, where the government had been carrying out law enforcement operations against the Tigray People's Liberation Front, the TPLF, an ethnic Tigray radical nationalist organization that ruled Ethiopia for nearly three decades with economic and development support from the West. Western governments, mainly the United States and the United Kingdom, have been also accusing Ethiopia of obstructing humanitarian activity in the Tigray region of Ethiopia. Recently, the Western allegations against Ethiopia took a new twist when a claim was made that famine is being used as a political weapon in the region. Provisional administration of the Tigray region of Ethiopia dismissed the allegation, saying it is baseless, that it has a negative impact on the effort to stabilize the region. And you can read this article in its entirety by merely logging on to the Pan-African Newswire. Finally, the head of the Sovereign Council in the Republic of Sudan and South Sudan's Joint Border Committee, the JBC, they said they're going to quickly reach an agreement that would make the borders flexible and allow for social and economic interaction. The JBC members Thursday briefed Abdel Fattah el-Burhan about the outcome of a series of meetings on the border and the disputed areas held in Khartoum from Monday to Thursday. The head of the Sudanese side, Muaz Tango, said that the two sides made great progress during the four-day meeting. He added they discussed the documents supporting the positions of each party regarding the delimitation of the borderline as of the 1st of January of 1956. In a statement released after the meeting, the chairman of the Transitional Sovereignty Council, Abdel Fattah el-Burhan, urged the JBC to expedite the completion of the demarcation of the international boundary between the two states. In addition to the JBC official mandate, el-Burhan called on the committee to cooperate with the relevant authorities and encourage them to open the crossings and make the borders between the two countries flexible to facilitate the free movement of citizens on the border strip and to interact economically and socially, the statement further said. Michael McQuay, head of the South Sudanese side, said that they briefed el-Burhan on the progress made by the Joint Border Commission in its works. He said the parties exchanged documents that will be studied by the two sides before resuming discussions in the near future. With that, we're going to conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of our program. We want to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998, and since that time, it has published thousands upon thousands of articles and dispatches in various newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. And if you want to log on to the Pan-African Newswire, so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. panafricannews.blogspot.com. And if you'd like to have access to today's Pan-African Journal, the worldwide radio broadcast for Saturday, June 19th, that's Juneteenth of 2021, all you need to do is go to the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We'll take a break with Memphis Mini, and we'll be back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week. Welcome back, and that was the music of Memphis Mini. And, of course, so we're going back to Zambia to deal with the aftermath of the passing of former President Dr. Kenneth Kaunda, the co-founder of the modern Zambian state, a Pan-Africanist, staunch supporter of national liberation movements and African unity. And this is a biographical sketch of some of the contributions of President Kenneth Kaunda. Let's listen in.
Few would have ever thought a boy born in a remote village at Luba Mission in Chinsali would go on to become Zambia's first president and one of Africa's great leaders. Few too would have ever imagined that a boy born in the same year when the British South Africa Company relinquished power to the colonial office in Britain would be the one to spearhead the fight against colonial rule and eventually succeed in ending it. Kenneth David Kaunda was born on April 28, 1924, from David Julisia Kaunda and Helen Nyamunyirenda. His full names are Kenneth David Buchizia Mtepa Kaunda. He was the last born of 8 children, with 5 surviving into adulthood. Kaunda was given the name Buchizia, meaning the unexpected one, for he was born in the 20th year of the marriage of his parents. Kaunda spent his childhood days at Luba Mission, a place founded by his father who opened the Bemba land to Christianity. It was at Luba that the young Kenneth Kaunda started his education and learned how to write and read. Kaunda was only 8 when his father died from a bout of pneumonia. He was the last child his father David saw and blessed before his death. Kaunda almost stopped school after his father's death. School authorities could not allow him back because his mother failed to raise 2 and 6 pence or half a crown. Ironically, this was a school his late father had established. This sad experience was to influence Kaunda's decision to have free education for all children once he took office in 1964. Although Kaunda initially regarded himself as a Chinsali man, his horizon was widened when he went to Munali in Lusaka, the only secondary school for black boys then, which was opened in 1939. It was at Munali where Kaunda interacted with other boys from Northern Province and became more aware of the political situation in the country. Kaunda was returned to Luba in 1943 to teach after completing his 2 grades, Standard 7 and 8, at Munali. It was during his days at Luba, after Munali, that Kaunda and his friends, who included Simon Mwansaka Pwepwe and John Malama Sokoni, became politically active. Kaunda recalls that in the company of his friends, who were teachers and members of Chinsali District Welfare Society, they would stage silent protests against colonial authorities who visited the area through the way they dressed. Kaunda and his friends later left Luba in search of employment in Mbeya, Tanzania, before proceeding to Salisbury, southern Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. But these international job hunts for Kaunda were unsuccessful and he had to return home. Kaunda recalls that fighting for the rights of Zambians started a long time ago with a few Zambians selected to sit on the Legislative Council and speak on behalf of Africans. The first Executive Council and Legislative Councils were set up immediately after the introduction of direct colonial office rule, but the Legislative Council comprised European settlers only, with no Africans. It was only after 1944 that things began to change when the Kitwe African Society, led by Mbekustele Wanika, issued the Kitwe Resolution, which among many things protested against the inappropriate and inadequate representation of African interests in the legislature. The society called for African interests to be represented by Africans elected by Africans. In 1948, the Northern Rhodesia African Congress, which was a forerunner to the African National Congress, ANC, was founded with Mbekustele Wanika as first president general with the first slogans, Unity in Teamwork and One Man, One Vote. Dr. Kaunda recalls that his role and that of other young people then was more advisory to the African members of the Advisory Council. At the time the Northern Rhodesia African Congress was founded out of the Federation of Welfare Societies, Kaunda was teaching in Mufira, but by then he had already made up his mind to dedicate himself to the independence struggle. He left his employment as a teacher and returned to Chinsali. Upon arrival, he engaged in activities that raised high level of political awareness not only in Chinsali, but the rest of Northern Province as well. In 1952, Harry Mwanga Nkumbula was to take over as second President General of the Northern Rhodesia African National Congress and transformed its name to African National Congress. The election of the firebrand Harry, who was fresh from Makerere University, raised the freedom struggle to another level. With his excellent organization abilities, which many had noticed, Kaunda was elected as Secretary General of the African National Congress, ANC, at a party congress held in 1953. The years that followed were active years of political mobilization and organization, and it was not long before Kaunda was arrested together with his president, Harry Mwangankumbula, for being in possession of what colonialists termed subversive materials. Kaunda's political life changed dramatically starting in 1958. The Congress Nationalist Movement, which had been held together for 10 years, split with the formation of the Zambia African National Congress, ZANC, the forerunner of the United National Independence Party, UNIP. The split was, among other issues, over differences between the militants, who wanted a boycott, and the moderates, who accepted to participate in elections based on the less than democratic 1958 constitution. All in all, Kumbula was accused by many of the youngsters of taking a casual approach to the struggle. ZANC was, however, not destined to live long. The party had become so militant, vibrant, and aggressive in their mobilization and organization against colonial rule. Its leaders were perceived as radical troublemakers. The party was banned, with its leaders arrested and jailed for 9 months in various parts of the country. The white settlers mocked the ZANC members with the phrase they termed Zafelatu, meaning ZANC was dead and dead for good. The campaign by Kaunda's group had two major results. First, the British government modified the Federation policy and eventually agreed to discard it. And secondly, and most importantly, the imprisonment of Kaunda and other militant leaders elevated them to the status of national heroes in the eyes of the people. Thus, from 1960 on, the nationwide support of Zambia's independence movement was secured, as was too the dominant status of Kenneth Kaunda. Kaunda came out of prison together with other ZANC leaders in 1960, and after 4 months he was elected president of UNIP, the United National Independence Party, formed by Mainza Chona and Paul Kalichini, while KK was in prison. UNIP under Kaunda was to push the independence struggle further into an aggressive drive and adopted what they called passive non-violent action, a form of civil disobedience against the Federation policy. This was the Cha-Cha-Cha period. It was a period of heated speeches, aggressive campaigns, and clashes. It was during this period that Mrs. Linda Burton, a white settler, was burnt to death near Ndola. Kaunda went into reflections and published two books, Black Government, together with Colin Morris, and later, Zambia Shall Be Free. In 1963, the road to independence started lighting up. Following an election under which the ANC and UNIP later went into a pact, a coalition government was formed, with UNIP securing 14 seats, ANC 7, while the UFP held 16 seats. Kaunda, known to some then as Mr. UNIP, entered the Legislative and Executive Council for the first time as Minister of Local Government. As for ANC, Mr. Harry Mwangankumbula, who had earlier been a member of the Legislative Council, became Minister of African Education. In much of his work, Kaunda was guided by the philosophy of humanism, which put a human being at the center of everything.
We are speaking of two lines of evil in the society of man today. One, exploitative international capital, with its offshoots of imperialism, colonialism, neo-colonialism, Zionism, fascism, racism, and apartheid. On one hand. On the other hand, you have poverty and its offshoots of hunger, ignorance, disease, crime, corruption, and above all, exploitation of man by man.
But events, mainly international, were to shatter Kaunda's mainly socialist policies aimed at national development. In 1973, the massive increase in the price of oil was followed by a slump in copper prices in 1975, and a serious reduction in export earnings. This resulted in Zambia having a massive balance of payments crisis and debt to the International Monetary Fund, IMF. It also derailed further development plans that pushed for major investment in infrastructure and manufacturing. With the economic situation becoming almost unbearable in the late 1980s, agitation for multi-party system of governance was equally gaining ground. Public discontent against Kaunda's government was growing, and a drastic government economic austerity plan did not help matters. It had instead provoked a wave of unrest. This situation indirectly begged for intervention, and a group of economists, businessmen, lawyers, and many others from various walks of life gathered at Garden House Motel in Lusaka in July 1990 to look at a multi-party option. The Movement for Multi-Party Democracy, MMD, was born. It immediately gained ground and was assuming influence and authority with each passing day. Dr. Kaunda eventually gave in to calls for a multi-party democracy. He announced the bold decision during the opening of a national council meeting of his United National Independence Party, UNIP. Here, he proposed constitutional amendments to restore multi-party democracy and parliamentary and presidential elections by October 1991. In effect, Dr. Kaunda had agreed to cut short his rule by 2 years and call early elections, a feat many describe to date as unprecedented on the continent. At a time when one-party states were common and when many leaders had a strong grip on governments, few would have expected KK, as he was fondly known, to cut down his reign. He had also decided the nation would not have a referendum because he did not want to divide the people. Was it a question of confidence or just facing reality, or indeed a decision guided by the need to safeguard peace? October 31, 1991, Zambia held its first multi-party elections for parliament and the presidency since the 1960s. MMD's candidate, Frederick Chiluba, won the presidential election over Kenneth Kaunda with 81% of the vote.
I, Frederick Jacob Chiluba, having been constitutionally elected to the office of President of the Republic of Zambia.
To add the MMD landslide in the parliamentary elections, the MMD won 125 of the 150 elected seats and UNIP the remaining 25. After leaving office, Dr. Kaunda had a rough time trying to settle. He had no house and was to be accommodated at a mine guest house where he was later evicted by the Dr. Frederick Chiluba government. KK stepped down as UNIP leader in 1992. However, he returned to active politics in 1995 with the party sidelining Kevin Sokotwani, who had assumed the leadership of UNIP. His return was, however, not a smooth one. KK was barred from contesting the presidency in the 1996 general elections by a change in the constitution. He was later arrested on Christmas Day in 1997 on allegations of concealing knowledge of an attempted coup that happened in October that same year. To Kaunda, it was unthinkable that he could be linked to a coup plot when he had advocated non-violence all his life. He started a hunger strike to push government to release him and to protest his innocence. As part of the protest, Dr. Kaunda also stopped shaving. The arrest was not the end of his political problems. In 1999, a court ruled that KK should be stripped of his citizenship because his parents were from Malawi. KK mounted a legal challenge and his citizenship was restored. In 2000, KK finally bowed out of active politics and diverted his energies to a fight against HIV and AIDS and to the Kenneth Kaunda Children's Foundation. Although the international community recognized KK's role with various awards, in Zambia, Kaunda's integrity was to be fully restored almost 12 years after he left office by President Levi Mwanawasa.
Whereby you have selflessly dedicated your whole life to the liberation of Africa with space.
He was decorated with the medal known as Order of the Eagle of Zambia, 1st Division, for his eminent role as statesman. Today, Turkey stands out as Zambia's colossus as an international statesman, pan-Africanist, nationalist, national president, a strong family man with strong family values. Kaunda is a lover of sport, particularly golf and football. KK looks back at his long and distinguished life and public service and can afford to sing his favorite song, "The Lord is My Shepherd."
Welcome back, and that was a short audio documentary biography of Dr. Kenneth Callender, the former president of the Republic of Zambia, the co-founder of the Republic of Zambia, a Pan-Africanist leader who made immense contributions to the African Revolution. And, of course, right now we want to move into our Black Music Month segment. First segment deals with none other than the legendary Dinah Washington. Let's listen in.
Thank you. We'd like to welcome back to the bandstand Ms. Dinah Washington.
There was one here where she is one of her blonde pictures. Yeah, in full mink.
Why not take all of me?
And this is at a recording session, you know.
Can't you see?
One day she decided that she wanted to be a blonde, so she bought a blonde wig and became one. Gentlemen prefer blonde.
There was only one Dinah.
How can I?
She was the most outrageous one of the bunch.
You.
And that's being pretty outrageous.
Took the part. That what was my heart.
She was the queen of the hands in your face. Like, she just did not care.
Come and get the rest of me.
Some people say she had 8 husbands, some people say 9, I lost count. She was a pistol. I've never met anybody like her. My mother, Miss Dinah.
My sister loved her furs. She even had a mink toilet seat.
This was at the Newport Jazz Festival. 1958 brought the house down because, of course, nobody knew that Dinah could play the vibes. She was a marvelous piano player.
I said, first of all, I understand you torture all the piano players. He said, play so-and-so, bitch. And I said, play so-and-so, bitch. I said, well, play it yourself, bitch. You're supposed to be a piano player.
She could be evil. Yes, she could.
Well, Dinah, you've been called the queen of the blues, but you've also been called the queen of the jukeboxes. Do you think that both of those names are flattering to you?
Well, you should hear some of the other names I've been called.
If she had cursed somebody out, then the publicity was bad. If they were reviewing her music, then it was almost always good. She was such a wonderful singer, and there was nothing that she couldn't sing.
Well, your goodbye left me with eyes that try.
There's something about her voice that puts it on sort of a cutting edge. There's a, like, don't you mess with me. Wonderful.
Why don't you rush back and support the rest? Come on, baby. Come on, daddy, and get all of me. Yeah. Come on, baby. Come on, daddy, and get all of me.
You couldn't categorize Dinah. You couldn't put her in, you know, in a box. She was a jazz singer. She was a blues singer. She was a pop singer. She was all of those. And, of course, she started out as a gospel singer.
Talk a lot about her childhood. Every once in a while we'd get little bits and pieces, like when she was small she would tell my mother, I want to be a showgirl. That's what she told my mother when she was real little.
she is a migrant from the South, part of the largest mass migration of African Americans. She embodies that kind of Southern background, but also this sense of modernity and the urban.
I've got a diamond in my pocket and a long, long way to go.
They have this sense of defiance, this sense of we're a new generation, and we're going to lay the groundwork for what will become known as the Civil Rights Movement.
Tell me, baby, have you any sweet women hanging around? Tell me, baby, have you any sweet women hanging around? You better throw them out because your mama's homeward bound.
Boy, this really brings back old memories. The church was right here. My grandmother and my mother attended the church often. My mom started singing here at St. Luke's as a little girl, and she was married here. Also, her funeral was here. As I look around, this brings back a lot of old memories.
My mother was a choir director when she was in Alabama, and she played at different churches in Chicago. My sister went along with her. I was always amazed at how well Dinah played.
God bless your heart. Giving honor to the Lord. And
my grandmother, if you didn't go to church, you'd hear about it for the next 2 weeks.
It was very simple. After going to church, we'd come home and eat and go to another church. We wouldn't get home till 10, 11 o'clock at night. From church, church, church. My grandmother was the strongest woman I've ever seen. And my mother, so. Clang, battle.
This is Dinah and her mother at a recording session. And obviously Dinah was playing the piano. Her mother was singing in the background. I guess with her habits, she felt that she couldn't do a gospel album, get away with it. But I'm sure she could have and done wonders.
I want to be loved with inspiration. I wanna be loved starting tonight.
Dinah is one of the most soulful singers that I've ever heard. She's soulful before soul music. It's always a sort of place in her voice that's like home. You know, it's the place to which she always returns, I think.
Until I tingle, starting tonight.
She sits at the very beginning of a lineage where we see the emergence of someone like Aretha Franklin, who absolutely loved Dinah Washington.
Wrong or right.
My grandmother wanted her to stay in church and sing. And my mother, she would go and sneak out with my uncle, Andrew Tibbs. He was a singer also. And they would sneak out to the Southside clubs and sing. And they would get home before my grandmother would wake up.
I'm an evil gal. Don't you bother with me. Yeah.
Eventually, someone told my grandmother, and she was furious. Oh, boy.
I'll empty your pockets and fill you with misery. I've got men to the left, men to the right, men every day and men every night. I've got
the people who had money during those times were numbers runners, black gangsters, with their contingent. She grew up in those neighborhoods and with those people. And so those people connected with her, and she enjoyed performing for them.
Men in the east, men in the west, but my man here in Harlem always loves me the best. I'm an evil gal.
When I think about her singing Evil Gal Blues, that was her. I mean, when she and my mother would get angry at each other, I was afraid of both of them.
If you want to be happy, don't hang around with me.
Long before I was born, my mother had won a talent show right here at the Regal. It was a really big moment. My grandmother didn't like it at all because she knew the outcome. She knew she would stop going to church and pick up all the bad habits in the streets and start drinking and hanging out. And my grandmother was definitely right, but, you know, it didn't happen all the time, you know, but mostly it was business. The voice like that, you couldn't hold her back.
Loved Bessie Smith. She loved Billie Holiday. Those were two of her idols, and you could tell it in her singing if you listened to her real good.
Now when I start to dive in, we need the groovy move.
Prior to her becoming Dinah Washington, she was Little Ruth Jones.
It was a club owner in Chicago who told her that she had a lot of talent, but that her real name, Ruth Jones, just wasn't going to cut it. She needed something, as he put it, that rolled off the tongue like rich liquor. And he came up with Dinah Washington.
Hello, honey. I don't believe I caught the name.
Oh, I forgot to tell you, I'm Dinah Washington.
Oh, Dinah Washington.
In 1942, Dinah started her career as an 18-year-old kid on a bus full of men, the Lionel Hampton Band, the only girl on the bus.
It was a swinging band. People would be fighting each other to try to get into the ballroom where we were playing. She was still a young girl coming from a church choir, so there were a lot of things she didn't know about makeup and clothing and the way she dressed and so forth. The guys in the band would say, geez, why would she wear something like that?
Racism was a very blatant part of the everyday living experience. It was a rough time for music, and especially for a young black woman.
You drove down the highway and you had to figure out a way we can drive this far because we know there's going to be a boarding house where we can stay. We know there's a gas station where we can get gas. We know there's a place that will serve us, but we have to go to the back door. Things that white Americans never had to think twice about.
Hey, what are you doing after the show?
You haven't even asked me what I'm going to do on the show.
Oh, I see. Well,
Whatever it is, who's complaining? But tell us about it, Dinah.
Anyway, I came here to sing a brand new ballad, Million Dollar Smile.
Million Dollar Smile.
Every time you smile, you dim the sunshine. You're a dream that words cannot define.
She was powerful enough to be heard over the brass sections, and that takes some doing, actually. She made a great contribution to that band. Nobody sang like her, and nobody played like that band either.
I lose my blue mood.
Here's a woman who's a great singer. She's ambitious, and yes, she's with Lionel Hampton, one of the biggest names, but she gets to sing two songs a night, and that just wasn't enough. By the time Dinah decided to strike out on her own, November 1945, right away people in the know sit up and take notice.
Now listen here, all you women. Every time you want to be wooed.
When Dinah started, they actually had race charts, and the black race chart at that time was called the Harlem Hit Parade, and then they were various charts. And so one would look and see where a particular artist charted.
It was a blatant race market, and what it did, it restricted you to specific categories, and that category determined what airplay you had, if any, what kind of publicity you had, if any, and it was really restrictive. And so she was, in a sense, a blues artist. That's where they had placed her, and people began to call her the Queen of the Blues.
And now it's star time at the Apollo Theater, and what could be finer than my Dinah? Here she is, the Queen of the Blues, Miss Dinah Washington.
My lean baby's tall and thin, 5'7", of bones and skin. But when he tells me maybe he loves me, I feel as whirly as a girly can be. He's so skinny, he's so drawn. When he stands sideways, you think he's gone. But when he calls me baby, I feel fine to think he's frantically, romantically mine.
There were some records that my mother didn't let us listen to. And I think one of them was Long John Blues. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, just get a copy of that. And now I know why my mother didn't want us to listen to that record.
He took out his trusty drill, and he told me to open wide. He said he wouldn't hurt me, but he'd feel my hole inside. Long John, Long John, you've got that golden touch. You thrill me when you drill me, and I need you very much.
In 1948, she was earning enough money that she bought the family a house. And this is really striking. A black woman in Chicago earning enough money to buy a house.
When he got through, he said that will cost you 10.
Whenever she would come home, the whole neighborhood would be out. Oh, there she is, there she is. And I could say to myself, that is my sister.
These famous people would come to the house. Duke Ellington, Count Basie. People would come. My mother was a very good cook. She didn't allow them to smoke or drink in her house. But they could come and they could eat all they wanted.
We'd have all these big Thanksgiving dinners, and then my mother would pray over the food for about 5 minutes, and everybody would be saying, well, I wish she would just be quiet so we could eat.
Dinah said she never wanted to live again where she had to walk upstairs in the cold water flats, etc. The things that she could have, she wanted to have them. I have arrived. I am the queen. Not just queen of the blues, but the queen.
Well, hello there. I'm glad you can be with us tonight because this is a most unusual party with the most unusual guest of honor. And here it comes now. that fabulous beauty, Ford's new four-passenger Thunderbird.
My grandmother, Thunderbird. My grandmother said, I can't go to church in that Thunderbird. So she took it back and got her something low-key.
Lord, Lord, Lord.
She loved being the queen. She had the attitude that, hey, I'm not going to let you get away with it. Because I am a black woman, because I am fat and you don't think I'm attractive, you're not going to walk on me. And because I'm going to fight back. And she did.
Well, it ain't nobody's business what I do.
Being the United States in the 1950s, there was a very clear demarcation between the music played for the black community and white mainstream America.
Buy me a shotgun.
What black musician wouldn't want to cross over for the obvious reason that it means better bookings, more record sales, more money.
When your favorite stops a Howard Johnson shop for an ice cream sundae with a cherry on the top.
So it was a sweet moment for Dinah when it turned out that she was the first black woman singer whose music was in Howard Johnson's jukeboxes. And it was just a little measure of her growing popularity and her recognition.
Sundae with a cherry on the top.
What makes her so important is that she sits at a kind of crossroads in so many ways. I think of her almost as the female Ray Charles. You know, she sang country and western. She sang rhythm and blues. She was actually one of the first queens of rhythm and blues.
Dinah famously said, I can sing anything, anything at all, and she was right. She could deal with any kind of material.
I've tried so hard, my dear, to show that you're my every dream.
Dinah would cover white pop music, particularly country music, as a way of introducing that to a black audience. And later on, she'd bring rhythm and blues to white audiences.
A memory from your lonesome past keeps us so far apart.
But no matter what she was singing the blues. That was always at the core of whatever Dinah sang.
She could do, adjust them, and make it her own. And then when she went back to what she knew, the blues, she could kill people. Kill people.
How many times a year do you say baby get lost?
As many times as, you know.
We play bass, we play drums.
Just like I'm telling you right now, get lost.
Get lost, Dad. You told me a little while ago that you want to dedicate something to somebody.
I'd like to very much.
What does he play? Drums?
Yes, he does.
Where does he live?
Well, he lives in Washington, but right now he's in Wildwood, New Jersey.
Wildwood, New Jersey?
Yes.
Where do you get all these squares? You know you're a lucky girl.
Why?
You pick up on all these squares.
Good. You didn't get the last word. What is it? I dare you.
I don't know how many times she was married. I know when she married Eddie Chamley and somebody came up to Dinah and Dinah cursed him out. And Eddie says, no, baby. Says, I'm here. I'm your husband. I'm doing the cursing now.
Only a moment ago, you suddenly smiled. Whispered hello with no introduction beforehand. I felt my hand melt into your hand. Only a moment ago, my bumpy heart was letting me know.
She did a lot of heartache songs. That's because at that time, she was going through heartaches. Her marriages went bad.
Romance in all of its glory.
She married a series of musicians who were partly looking out for their own interests. I don't want to use the word pimp, but in reality, it was pimping on a young girl who was making money, sometimes more than they.
One kiss and I was aflame. Have you got eyes?
This is just strictly my opinion. She was a very difficult person to get along with. And she was very opinionated. And it was like her husbands were Mr. Dinah Washington. So she just couldn't stay married because they didn't like that situation.
It's hard to believe I was lonely.
Well, that happens to a lot of entertainers. When the woman is making more money than the man. She told me she was pushed down the stairs by her first son, George, his father. He was a drummer, and he got mad at her and threw her down a flight of stairs when she was pregnant, getting ready to have a baby. She told me a lot of things that were horrible.
Only a moment ago, you might have gone by, and I'd never know. It's hard to believe I was lonely.
Hard because she wouldn't come in town but short visits. And we'd have a good time. We'd go places. And she'd say, well, I have to leave. And, you know, we would, it would tear us up because no telling when she'd come back. She'd be gone sometime for months at a time.
If you want to have fun, come home with me. You can stay all night and play with my TV. TV is
sent
a thing
us all
this
types
year,
of
this year.
Weird toys.
TV is a thing.
Her gifts year. Were extravagant.
Radio was great. Now it's out of date.
Ah, I've gotten TV diamond cufflinks. Big fur collared coats.
I was watching old Tom Mix.
All the latest styles now. We were up on it.
I was in a fix. I got on the phone. Called my man. Said, get here, daddy, as fast as you can. TV is the thing this year. Oh, TV is the thing this year. Radio was great.
Me and Liberace, we were the only ones that had this particular suit. Tailor made. I don't think I was, 12, 13 years old.
I knew that this was gonna be fun.
I still had that suit.
Channel 2, that station thrilled me through and through. He moved one notch to channel 3. I said, how I love what you're
doing. When I was 16 years old, she gave me a mink stole. When I was 17, she gave me a full-length mink coat.
Just about the time someone knocked on the
she
door.
Was the queen of bling. She might have been the first queen of bling.
This is my queen picture. Well, one of them. She was the crown and the white fur and all of that. Believe it or not, she was a fashion plate. And when you see pictures of Dinah, she was always in style. The problem is that her body double-crossed her because the body didn't suit the clothes.
Sometimes the band boys would make fun of her. It was never popular to be fat, that's all. So she tried to keep herself thin.
She got a lot of criticism from the press on all kinds of fronts. She was criticized because of her wigs and the color of her wigs. She was criticized for her dress, and she was criticized for her weight. And naturally, it hurt her.
Being chubby was just a way of life to me. My mother was chubby, I was chubby, she was chubby, we were all chubby, so chubby was the thing. I didn't realize that she was having a weight problem until one time I look and she's big and then she comes home and she's very, very small. And we all became concerned when she would do anything to keep the weight off.
Welcome back, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast. And this is our Black Music Month segment for today, Saturday, June 19th, 2021. Our focus right now is on the lifetimes and contributions of Dinah Washington. And let's go back to this very important documentary on the legendary Queen of the Blues, Dinah Washington.
Poor baby. She became a victim of that time. You could take what they call black bombers. You could take amphetamines, dexedrine and multazine and all kinds of zines that were supposed to make you feel good and take your appetite away. I think Dinah fell into that trap.
She was a walking pharmacy, and she had pills to lose weight. She had pills to sleep. She had pills not to sleep. She had pills for sex. She had pills not to, I mean, all kinds of pills. Stage, Dinah put a shield, a protective shield, as a defense mechanism. But then there's a saying in basketball that the best defense is an offense.
Dinah never sings about poor me. The persona that she creates on stage and on record is someone who would be appalled at pity.
And it's wonderful now that I don't hurt anymore.
If I have a bad day, I can still put on Dinah Washington and just be like, you know what? Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's nothing. It's a nothing. You listen to her and it just... It just pulls you out of yourself. It just pulls you out of your situation.
But now I find you're out of my mind. And I can't believe that.
And you know, she didn't really have a beautiful voice. She didn't have a beautiful voice like Sarah Vaughan. It was a little strident, wasn't it? But she had marvelous diction, good range, and she also knew how to control her voice and make a beautiful sound.
Very strong. Ella's voice was young, forever young. And Sarah was smooth. And Lady was bending the notes. And then there was Dinah. And Dinah had a voice that could cut through anything.
Her voice was so strong, she didn't really need a mic. Her voice was strong as like the old-time opera singers who could stand on the stage and just, you know, fill the whole theater.
This is at a recording session. She was a perfectionist when it came to dealing with her music. And so she was very intense and intent on making sure that all of the pieces fit. So she wanted to work with people who knew what they were doing.
Foggy day in London town,
Dinah had an innate jazz feel. That was one of the things that made her so flexible. She had wonderful time and phrasing. You can tell how she is inspired by, and in turn how she inspires the players.
She would do things like she'd finish one tune in one key, and she didn't want an introduction on the next tune, which would be totally unrelated to the tune she just finished, in another key.
There's been a whole lot of changes made, Daddy, and it's all on account of another bride, another groom, another sunny honeymoon.
Right on the note she's supposed to start on.
For making movies.
I mean, that's really absolute pitch, as they call it. So for 2 years, the 2 years that I worked with her, I said, each night I said, she's going to miss tonight. You know, like she put two tunes back on and said, she's going to miss. She never missed. Never.
He says he's busy, and she says, is he? Uh-uh, he's making whoopee. Well, he doesn't make much money. Only $5,000.
Dinah had a really good sense of humor, and she used to add bits in. Like when they get divorced and making whoopee, and the judge says if you can't like pay her money for it, you have to go to jail. And she literally says a little ha, like in between it, which is pure her.
He says, now judge, suppose I fail. The judge says, ha ha ha, into jail. You better keep her. I think it's cheaper than making whoopee. Well, it's a whole lot cheaper than making whoopee.
Humor, just like she's just wicked.
I absolutely adore Dinah, but I've seen her in action, so she had some moments when she dealt with people that didn't suggest a lot of love.
She was very temperamental, you know, but a lot of that came because she wanted the music to be perfect, too perfect. And she jumped keys, person knew how to go there without her telling me. And I could do that. She would call me up. I said, where are you? I'm in Hamburg, Germany. You better come back with me. I'm the right person for you to be with. I said, oh, yeah? I said, I'm going to send you a book on manners.
She'd just tell you exactly the way she felt. There was nothing held back with her. For a little, reluctant to go up and talk to her, because she couldn't be bothered with you. She'd just tell you right there and then.
I've been present at some of those tirades on stage. If people were not paying attention, and she was doing a show, she would stop in the middle of the show, single them out, and curse them out from the stage.
I don't know what she was saying, but whatever it was, she was doing it expressively. I know she went through piano players. She was terrifying. This is Patty right here. Patty Bowen.
So many pianists, they wanted to kill her. But she liked you. She didn't want you to leave. And so she would hold back the money. I said, I understand. Whitney Kelly took a coat hanger and tried to choke you to death. He was tired of not getting his money. I said, you ain't going to play me that way, girl. If I don't get paid my money, hey, I'm gone, sister. You'll see some smoke where I was.
Love for sale. Got love that's fresh and still unspoiled. Got love that's only slightly soiled. Love for sale. Bye.
to pay the price for our trip to paradise.
We always had a little bag full of clean stockings, so she didn't have to run out to the store. Let the poet pipe of love. Same way with her shoes. She had up to 200-300 pairs of shoes. We usually travel with at least 50 pairs. If you want the thrill of love, I lived with her in an apartment near the Apollo. It was gorgeous. We look out her bedroom and look down St. Nicholas and look up St. Nicholas.
After we moved to New York with my mother, everything, my whole world changed. The things that went on in New York were a little more looser.
Relax, my.
Everybody that was entertaining at the Apollo, they would all come over after the show and wake us up 4 o'clock in the morning and party till the sun would come up. Bumping, jumping, up and down.
Stay cool, cool. I remembered something that Dinah's father told me. He said, girl, show business people are crazy. You find yourself in a situation you don't want to be in. So I'm telling you, stay to yourself and don't be messing with them people. And I paid attention to him. You know, I would help get ready for the party, but then I would go in my room and lock the door.
You had one of everything at all her parties. You had governors, you had mayors. It had all the musicians. That's where I learned how to throw parties by my mother.
When you do, I love you, love you, love you like you want to.
Oh, this was at a party at her house, and she was clowning. You know, she was saying, people don't think I can do anything but sing. And so she did this balancing act on the back of the chair.
When the press smelt something, it'd be on the front page of the newspaper the next day. Dinah did this, Dinah did that. She was in the paper every day. Dinah had her drug addicts in her house. She had a big party.
A great big hand for the most talked about young lady in the field. A big hand for the queen of the blues, Dinah Washington. Nice having you, dear.
Thank you.
What are you going to sing first?
Too soon to know.
We've had a request for it. We haven't played it just because we knew you were going to make it.
Good.
So,
let's play.
Go. Go. No bass this time.
Ooh, you sing. Does he love me? It's too soon to know. Can I believe him when he tells me so? Is he fooling? Is this just a game? Am I the fire? Or just another flame?
There's no artist that I regard highly unless they really stand out, you know? That she stood out. I don't really do any Dinah songs because she made them her own. It's a bit like covering Aretha Franklin. It's a bit like slitting your own throat. What's the point?
I took a trip on a train, and I thought about you.
I remember there was one song that she sang. I took a trip on a train, and I thought about you. And I don't know what it was about this song, but it touched me emotionally.
Thought about you. There were two or three cars.
The first time I played it, I cried while I was playing. And she looked around and she says, oh, I got you. And I think it happened maybe another two or three times. And each time she'd look around at, after that song and she'd say, ah, got you again. Very emotional singing.
On some little town.
People connected with that. Her audience is connected with that.
And each scene showed me the same old dream.
The kinds of songs
that she made very famous went beyond the simple blues with which for which she was best known in the early days. To do the great songs with the great arrangers required lush sounds. Lush sounds meant woodwinds and strings.
A day made, 24 little hours.
What a Difference a Day Makes was Dinah's first big crossover hit. Kind of hipper white listeners had been listening to her all along, but that song in particular brought her to the attention of a lot more people.
My yesterday was blue, dear.
Dinah is trying to communicate a sense of refinement, and like most migrants of her generation, that she's not country, that the raw edges of the country have been smoothed. She liked Frank Sinatra. She liked Nat King Cole. She liked Ray Charles. Each of them was considered very soulful. They also had a sense of a kind of elegance, a kind of urbanity and modernity.
Skies above can't be stormy. Since that moment of bliss, that thrilling kiss, it's...
She loved the use of strings. I was very particular about the way the strings sounded. She could almost pick out one or two musicians who she thought might be making the kinds of sounds she didn't like. You didn't get too many second chances with Dinah.
Is you.
She liked to sing pretty songs. Songs where she could bend the lyrics to suit herself, to really inject herself into the song, to tell a story. She wanted to tell beautiful stories.
I'm mad about a boy.
I walked into the Shaperie or somewhere in Chicago, and she saw me, and she said, "Wait till you see what I got." She called out a name, and this young Hispanic boy walked on. He was much younger and slim and sweet.
On the silver screen, he melts my foolish heart in every...
This is someone who didn't want to be alone. It became clear to me with number three, number four, number five, and number six, that Dinah made sure that she was the one who was doing the leaving. She didn't want to be left. Number five, Eddie Chambly, they broke up on stage. She literally did take a saxophone and throw it against the wall.
My favorite thing about her is she was someone who had a real air of, you know, she didn't care. Like a man would say to her, something like, "You know what, I've had enough." She'd be like, "You've had enough. You're 2 months late. I've had enough." Like, she'd be like... She's the kind of woman that wouldn't even dignify a man with a response.
This odd diversity of misery and joy.
Anytime you marry seven times, you're not happy. You're looking for something, and you haven't found it.
This bitter earth, well, what's the fruit it bears? What good is love? That no one shares.
Those songs meant a lot to her. you can only sing certain songs if you have really lived that those words.
Ooh, that hides the glow of a rose. What good am I?
Dinah had a boyfriend who was like extremely young. He decided to go get some chicks that were like his age, you know. She had taken this boy's clothes and put him in the bathtub and poured gasoline on him and lit a match. And she was sitting there crying, singing, "This bitter earth." And I said, "If you don't give me my money, I'm going to blow up this place." She gave me all my money.
Today, you're young.
She was feisty. She was clever. She was very colorful. I mean, she would just mess their mind up.
But while a boy...
And this one is a beautiful picture. I'm watching every move you make, Bill. So be careful, my love. You're D. P.S. I do love you still. Just remember Indiana. Oh, well, that's when we first really met each other good.
And this bitter earth, ooh, may not, oh, be so bitter after all.
After 44 years, I still love her. I was a police officer, and Dinah had asked me to look out for her while she was in Chicago. The neighborhood was such that she needed to have somebody be around there to keep any problems happening.
Hey, brother, now y'all now show me the way to get my soul down. Show me the way to go home. Show me the way to get the soul.
It's kind of ironic now that it's a big, fabulous church at one town. Back in the heyday, it was one of the best places in town to go to. You couldn't get a parking space within blocks. Guys, I remember the long lines, people were trying to get in.
Old folks who know all the tricks. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Gonna eat some soul food.
Oh, it was so beautiful.
Well, now,
she called it Dinaland.
It'll make you quit.
And she had all of her friends. The entertainers were coming in. It was a lot of fun.
She had people coming from Hollywood. All the Western stars on TV in that day would be there on stage drawing their guns.
She always carried a gun with her. It was nothing for her to pull a gun on somebody if she didn't think that they were doing her right.
I was afraid for her. A lot of the people who were, what do you call it, hang-ons, who would always want to be with the entertainer or be seen with the entertainer, some of those are dangerous people. She knew gangsters. She knew all the politicians. She knew all the bums. And they would all flock around her. You could smell the lowlifes coming.
Dinah loved a good time, and she came down in a silver blue mink and a blonde wig, and somehow the wig came askew. It was off to the side, because she went straight to the bandstand and would start to sing with whoever was playing.
Since they're always saying, "Queen of the Blues, I'd like to give you the sound of a blues. I wrote it myself. I'm so blue, missing you. Moaning and groaning, crying and sighing all night through. I'm so blue."
This blonde wig that she had. I mean, when I saw her with that, I almost didn't know who she was. But you know what? Wigs have their place. If you want to change your personality, you put on a wig and then you can be whoever you wish to be. And I think this is the effect that she wanted to have.
She was always on diet pills. She couldn't sleep. I'd leave her at 5 o'clock in the morning. She would get pass keys to get into my room and sit. And when I woke up in the morning, there she was staring at me. I said, don't you have a home in this hotel? She wanted to talk. She was lonely.
I can't forget.
The sad thing is, she would pass out sometimes. And when she came to, she said, what are you fools standing around in bed? Pour me a drink. She always had to be tough. Everybody thought she was going to die. And she's busy laughing, you know. She didn't want to show that part of herself, I think, you know.
She drank a lot. And then she took a pill to sober up, and then she took a pill to go to sleep, and then she took, you know, and all this interaction and things like that. And I think that that's what just destroyed her.
Don't you know that's strange? When you win it, comes and goes in a minute.
She had just married with this football player out there in Detroit. I got the feeling that she was just delighted.
When you found him, grab a barrel of bricks and build your own little world around him.
Nat Train was the last husband before she passed. They weren't married but a few minutes.
Someone happy, you see, I've made Night Train Lane happy. So I'm sure, don't you know, that you can be just as happy too.
I remember so well this house where my Miss D lived. It was a night just like this evening. Quite very cold, bitter cold.
When you went in,
we went to sleep happily, knowing we're going to go shopping tomorrow morning. Night Train woke us up in the middle of the night and said, she's gone.
And someone happy.
Much too young to die, much too young, much too vibrant, much too everything to just die away like that.
Yeah, I'm kind of sure that you'll be real happy too.
I just started crying. I couldn't believe it. It just seemed like the most terrible thing that could possibly have happened.
It was really a tragedy. But I think when we hear Dinah today, we don't listen to her with teary eyes. She's got a lot of life there and a great spirit.
Blue sky smiling at me, nothing but blue sky do I see. Blue birds singing a song, nothing but bluebirds.
When you have a feeling for something someone is doing, you want to enhance it and make it more beautiful. It's like putting a setting around a stone. You make all the things mean something, so it brings out the brilliance of the stone.
Welcome back, and that was a tribute to the legendary Dinah Washington, who made her transition here in the city of Detroit, where we're broadcasting from. She passed away in December of 1963 from an apparent overdose of alcohol and other drugs. And right now we want to move into our final segment on Miss Willie Mae Thornton, popularly known as Big Mama Thornton, and we'll listen to the music of Big Mama Thornton.
I went down on Blake Street to get a glass of gin. Before I drank my gin, the FBI walked in. How unlucky. How unlucky can a poker be? Seems like everywhere I go, FBI's following me.
Welcome back, and that was the music of Mrs. Willie Mae Thornton, Big Mama Thornton. And Willie Mae Thornton was born on December 11th of 1926. She made her transition on July 25th of 1984. She was better known as Big Mama Thornton. She was an African-American rhythm and blues singer and songwriter. She was the first to record the Liebler and Strollers song Hound Dog in 1952, which became her biggest hit, staying 7 weeks at number one on the Billboard R&B chart in 1953. The song sold almost 2 million copies. Thornton's other recordings included the original version of Ball and Train, which she wrote. Thornton's birth certificate states she was born in Ayrton, Alabama. Nonetheless, in an interview with Chris Stravich, she claimed Montgomery, Alabama, as her birthplace, probably because Montgomery was better known than Ayrton. She was introduced to music in the Baptist church, where her father was a minister and her mother was a singer. She and her six siblings began to sing at an early age. Her mother died, and Willie Mae left school and got a job washing and cleaning in a local tavern. In 1940, she left home and, with the help of Diamond Peak Mary, joined Sammy Green's Hot Harlem Review and was soon billed as the new Bessie Smith. Her musical education started in the church, but continued through her observation of rhythm and blues singers such as Bessie Smith and Memphis Minnie, who we played earlier, whom Willie Mae Thornton admired. Let's hear a rare interview with Miss Willie Mae Thornton. This interview was done in the 1970s, we believe. Let's listen in.
Well, Mae, why don't we start off where you were born? Can you tell me a little bit about where were you born and when? What's your birthday?
11th of December.
11th of December?
Yeah, 11th of December. An Alabama kid.
Where, what town in Alabama were you
born? Montgomery.
In Montgomery. What was the year of your birthday? Mind telling us how old you are?
Well, that's a secret.
That's a secret. Oh, well. I'll never find out. Well, what did your folks do? Did any of them play music or sing? Or?
Well, my father, he was a minister. My mother, she's a Christian-hearted working woman. She sang Christian songs.
Did you ever sing with them in the church or when you were youngster?
Well, no, not exactly. I used to go to church a lot, but just singing, you know, I didn't do too much singing in church.
Did you grow up in the town of Montgomery or did you?
I left there when I was 14.
Oh, you left there when you were 14?
Yeah.
Did you leave with your folks or just take off on your own?
No, I left with a show.
Oh, you left with a show? What was that? What was the name of it?
The Sammy Green's Hot Harlem Review out of Atlanta, Georgia.
Is that right? How did they happen to find you? Did they hear you singing someplace?
Well, I did audition on his show when he was playing a little theater there in the hometown.
Oh, is that right? Hmm. And where did you tour?
We went Atlanta, Birmingham, and back home, and Columbus, Georgia, Macon, Georgia, North, South Carolina, and Florida. We just toured practically everywhere.
What year was this roughly? Can you tell us?
Well, in...
Before the war?
Well, I started before the war, and then after the war broke out, then we went to touring through Texas.
Hmm. What sort of things was this kind of a minstrel show or was it just a music?
Well, a stage show, like, you know, playing in theaters.
Did they have dancers and comics and all that?
Yeah, dancers, course, you know, course girls, comedians, singers.
And how long did you stay with them?
Well, up until 1948. That's when I left in Houston. I quit the show in Houston, Texas.
Did you go on your own from there in Houston?
Well, in Houston, I started recording records for Don Robey before I recorded from him, but he came out to the club I was working called the El Dorado Ballroom there on Elgin and Darlin to hear me sing. And right then, he wanted me under a contract, but I didn't sign right then.
Good. Who was some of the other people with you there at the time? Was it your band or did you just play as?
No, I was playing with a group called Smiley. He was here, Ike Smalley. He was the band leader there at the El Dorado. That was his band. And then after he left, another band came in, Pluma Davis and his rock. We call them the House Rockers, and they were doing pretty nice.
who were some of the other, you know, singers around town that you remember around, you know, 48, around Houston?
Around Houston then? Well, Gate Mouth Brown, he was real hot there. He was on Peacock label. And Roy Brown, he was in town. He was pretty hot around in that length of time. And I got a chance to meet Louis Jordan when he come to town. Big Joe Turner. And
he used to be a real favorite around Houston, didn't he?
Fats Domino, he was working around. That's when he put out this record. They called me the Fat Man.
How long did you stay around Houston then?
Well, in 51, I cut this record, Let Your Tears Fall, Baby. And I went to San Antonio, and I worked down there. I worked in San Antonio for a while. And when I came back, I was working around Houston, different little nightclubs. And Johnny Otis, he came in town. That was in 52. So we did an audition on his show that night when I was working with Gate Mob Brown. He wanted me to sing with his band. So I did a song with his band. And he liked the way I performed on the stage, so he hired me. So he took me on tour, New York.
Well, you toured with Johnny mm-hmm. Otis' band then?
Yeah, that's when I first went to the Apollo Theater in 52.
Oh, is that right? And did you also go to Los Angeles then?
Or? Well, we left Houston, and we went to Los Angeles. And while I was there, we recorded Hound Dog. But he did. Don Roby put it on the shelf. So we go from Los Angeles, played in California. We played the tour here, Sweets Ballroom, San Francisco, the Fillmore Auditorium. Then we go back to Los Angeles, and then we leave Los Angeles and go back through Houston, Texas, Battling the Blues with Gate Mob Brown. Then we leave there and we goes on through Florida and on back up on around the East Coast there coming into New York. It goes into Apollo. That was in June 52. So the last part of 52, we goes Providence, Rhode Island, and all the England states, Boston, Massachusetts, all around up through there.
And
so we leave Providence, that was pretty close to Christmas. And I was supposed to go back, at least I wanted to go home, kind of homesick, so I wanted to see the old gang. So I called a train, I leave New York, come back to Houston, and I got there just a little before Christmas. So Don Roby, he put me on a show in his nightclub. And I worked at Christmas and at New Year's out to his club, that was before they tore it down, it's called the Peacock. The Bronze Peacock, and they tore it down and made the office out of it. Now it's a big office where they cut records. They got a record studio in there where they record. And back in the back, they press their own records. In 1953, that's when I met Johnny Ace. So they sent me to Dayton, Ohio. That's where I joined him there. Playing, perform there at the theater there. I forget the name of the theater. But anyway, I was going to the theater, and I just turned the radio on in the car. And the man said, here's a record that's nationwide, Hound Dog by Willie Mae Thornton. I said, that's me. I hadn't heard the record in so long. So when we got to the theater, they was blasting it. You could hear it from the theater, from the loudspeaker on out. Oh, they just playing Hound Dog all over the theater. So I goes up in the operating room. I said, you mind play that again? Because the man held the record so long, I forgot the words myself. So I was up in the so I stood there while he was playing it, listening to it. So that evening, I sang it on the show. And everybody went for it. So Hound Dog just took off like a jet. Right now, I wish I'd get another dog with cat or something.
And then I guess you toured around. And when did you finally come back out here again?
Well, before I came out here, I went back into the Apollo Theater in February '55. And when I came back, I toured around up that part of the country. That's when I ran into Big Maybell when I was battling the blues. So, well, that tour ended that way, so I drove on back down through Alabama, Georgia, stopping over, seeing friends, because I didn't have anything else to do. So I goes back to Houston. Well, we go on a tour with Gate Mob Brown. I work around with him, doing 56, the first part of 56. around Thanksgiving I came out here, and I haven't been back.
How did Roby used to book you? Did he have a booking agency?
Well, Don Roby didn't actually book me. Evelyn Johnson was booking all the Buffalo booking agents.
Oh, I see. That isn't run by Roby, as much as
I know. Well, I don't know whether he had anything to do with it or not, but it's coming out of his office there.
Yeah.
You know, Peacock, you know, the stab
is
called.
Artist, yeah. How did you pick up most of your songs? Did you...
Some I wrote myself, some other people, you know, write, and I sang them. And...
Like about that Hound Dog and I Smell Rat, were those two writers there? Did they just happen to be there? Or?
Well, Jerry Lieber, he wrote Hound Dog and I Smell a Rat. Jerry Lieber and Mike Stroll, they wrote those two numbers there.
Mm-hmm.
And... they wrote both sides of that record, if I'm not mistaken. Nightmare was on the first Hound Dog. They wrote both sides of that record.
Mm-hmm. Were they from Houston or what?
No, actually, they are right now. They're from New York, but
mm-hmm.
they were staying in Los Angeles at the time when they.
Oh, I see. They were
you know, yeah, they were down in Los Angeles. They know Johnny Otis very well, you know.
I see. Because they've written a lot of songs, like for the Coasters, I think they wrote that Yakety Yak.
Yeah, and I know it wrote quite a bit.
And, yeah. who were some of your favorite singers when you were a youngster, you know, when you were just growing up?
Well, I didn't have no favorite singer. I just admired good singing, you know. But since...
Did you hear anybody you liked when you were in Birmingham still, or...?
No, well, and my favorite blues artists were Muddy Waters and Big Maceo and be surprised, Lowell Fulsom, all those cats, man, I admired them, you know.
Yeah,
Roy Brown, I sang all of his songs.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I didn't have no hit record, but I was singing everybody else's record.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I went into the Apollo Theater, you'd be surprised what I went over with, Big. Have Mercy, Mercy Baby by the Dominoes.
Oh, yeah.
Billy Ward the Domino. That time when Clyde McFadden was there with him, you know.
Yeah, I sure remember. That's about the time I, you know, got interested in this music.
That was the first time I had ever been to New York.
That song might actually be a good song for you to redo, that Have Mercy, Mercy Baby.
Yeah, that's a nice tune. I like
that. I have that record here. What did your parents think of it when you started singing kind of blues and that church music?
Well, I lost my mother in 39. Well, I wasn't singing blues when I was then.
No.
No, I wasn't doing anything. We're just staying around home. Time ran.
Is that when you left home after your mother died?
No, I didn't leave right away. I didn't leave right away.
But you said that you like to sing, you know, gospel songs. Have you ever, you know, seriously thought about, you know, making maybe some records of you know, spirituals and gospel songs?
I've thought about it a great deal. And I would like very much to do spirituals. Because I feel that I got the voice. I feel like I got the power. I just feel like I can just do them. I just like in a fat condition. You'd be surprised. Mostly my occupation every morning is turn on my radio, listen to spirituals. I love those spirituals. I love good singing. And like the Dixie Hummingbirds, the Soul Stirrers, Mahalia Jackson, the Davis Sisters. Oh, man, I mean, and the Five Blind Boys of Mississippi. Oh, they just knock me out, I'm telling you. When I hear good singing, I love it. In fact, I love all good singing.
Yeah, I think that's the
story.
You mean you sort of really got into blues because people wanted you to sing them more or less, rather
Well, how I got into blues, because I didn't know anyone at the time to do what I wanted to do. And back in this, when you're hungry, you try to make a fast buck to try to stop from being hungry. Yeah.
Well, I hope that you can, you know, do the things that you want to do as far as I'm concerned. You know, I'd like to make some records and do whatever you want to do. I mean, that's the way I look at it.
I would like very much to cut some spirituals. Get me a good group behind me and cut some nice old time spiritual records, because I like good singing.
I guess you don't want to talk too much about your early days. I'm always interested, you know, how people get started and how what you hear around you. I mean, you didn't hear much except your family and people and singing in church and so on.
No, not too much about that.
Who else was on that show that you auditioned for when you started? Were there any names that I may recognize?
Yeah, a young man was singing on the show at the time called Billy Wright.
Oh,
yeah. He made a nice hit record. And he was doing real nice on that. He got on Savoy label, and he was doing pretty nice on that. Mm. I haven't heard from Billy in quite a while.
Mm. But you don't remember hearing any low-down blues guys around your hometown?
No.
Guys like Muddy Waters, in that style. You didn't have
to. Well, and Muddy Waters and Jimmy Reed wasn't, I didn't hear of him until lately here. Yeah. Well, Muddy Waters, he was out. He was doing something. Howlin' Wolf, they was doing, they was on label.
Yeah, but you didn't hear any local people down there?
No.
Alabama.
No, the only thing I heard local was some spiritual quartets, and I don't forget the name of that, been so long.
It's very strange that there's so few, you know. Most of the blues singers seem to come out of Mississippi or Texas.
I didn't get to, you know, hear anything about nothing like that until after I had started singing and was already gone away. And then and people tell me, say, well, I'm from Montgomery, I'm from Alabama, or, you know, Tennessee. But I didn't know anything about them, you know, because they came along behind me.
How did you meet up with this fellow, Brad Taylor?
Brad Taylor? He got a record on the shelf. Do you know that Sentimental Reason thing I used to do? I cut a tape on that, and I don't know what he did. I guess he wore the tape out. He won't release the record.
Did you meet him when you worked in San Francisco again?
Yeah, I met Brad while I was working in Santa Cruz, San Francisco, around the Bay Area here.
Anything you want to tell us about yourself? Maybe you
want to
tell the world about.
Yeah, I need a job.
I need a job.
I need help.
Yeah.
See, so many youngsters jumping up now. They forget about.
Welcome back. And that was a rare interview with Willie Mae Thornton, better known as Big Mama Thornton, talking about some early aspects of her career in Alabama and, of course, her touring during the 1950s from the West Coast to the East Coast and all through the South. And this is Black Music Month 2021, and all during this month we're featuring various artists. We've looked at Evelyn Prayer, Adelaide Hall. We've looked at Charlie Parker. We've looked at Billie Holiday. And today, Dinah Washington and Willie Mae Thornton. And in future broadcasts this month, we'll have other artists that will be featured. We're winding down our program for today. This is Abayomi Azikiwe. If you want to have access to the program, just go to the Pan-African Radio Network at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal.
We're going to close out with Abby Lincoln from the album Straight Ahead, released in February of 1961, featuring Max Roach and Booker Little on trumpet, Nell Waldron on piano. Let's listen in.
Got a problem getting where you want to go. Speed limit's almost down to nothing. Straight ahead, but oh, Miss Lucy, put that music book away. What's the use to keep on trying if you practice till you're gray? You can't start no notes of flying like the ones that rant and rain from the kitchen to the big woods when Melinda sings. Easy enough for folks to holler, looking at the lines and dots, when there ain't no one can sense it, and the tune comes in spots. But for real melodic music that just strikes your heart and cling, just stand and listen with me when Melinda sings. Oh, it's sweeter than the music of an educated band, and it's dearer than the battle songs of triumph in the land. It seems holier than evening when those silent church bells ring, as I sit and calmly listen when Melinda sings. Melinda sings.